and thinking, and did not care to have her enticing imaginations broken in upon, so she said little or nothing. "What's the matter, Carrie?" said Hurstwood, after a time, noticing her quiet, almost moody state. "Nothing," said Carrie. "I don't feel very well tonight." "Not sick, are you?" he asked, approaching very close. "Oh, no," she said, almost pettishly. "I just don't feel very good." "That's too bad," he said, stepping away and adjusting his vest after his slight bending over. "I was thinking we might go to a show tonight."
"I don't want to go," said Carrie, annoyed that her fine visions should have thus been broken into and driven out of her mind. "I've been to the matinee this afternoon."
"Oh, you have," said Hurstwood. "What was it?"
"A gold mine."
"How was it?"
"Pretty good," said Carrie.
"And you don't want to go again tonight?"
"I don't think I do," she said.
Nevertheless, wakened out of her melancholia and called to the dinner table, she changed her mind. A little food in the stomach does wonders. She went again, and in so doing temporarily recovered her equanimity. The great awakening blow, however, had been delivered. As often as she might recover from these discontented thoughts now, they would occur again. Time and repetition, ah, the wonder of it! The dropping water and the solid stone, how utterly it yields at last! Not long after this matinee experience, perhaps a month, Mrs. Vance invited Carrie to an evening at the theater with them. She heard Carrie say that Hurstwood was not coming home to dinner.
"Why don't you come with us?
Don't get dinner for yourself. We're going down to Sherry's for dinner and then over to the Lyceum. Come along with us."
"I think I will," answered Carrie.
She began to dress at 3 o'clock for her departure at 5:30 for the noted dining room which was then crowding Delmonico's for position in society. In this dressing, Carrie showed the influence of her association with the dashing Mrs. Vance. She had constantly had her attention called by the latter to novelties in everything which pertains to a woman's apparel.
"Are you going to get such and such a hat? Or have you seen the new gloves with the oval pearl buttons?" were but sample phrases out of a large selection.
"The next time you get a pair of shoes, dearie," said Mrs. Vance, "get button with thick soles and patent leather tips. They're all the rage this fall."
"I will," said Carrie.
"Oh, dear, have you seen the new shirtwaists at Altman's? They have some of the loveliest patterns. I saw one there that I know would look stunning on you. I said so when I saw it." Carrie listened to these things with considerable interest, for they were suggested with more of friendliness than is usually common between pretty women. Mrs. Vance liked Carrie's stable good nature so well that she really took pleasure in suggesting to her the latest things.
"Why don't you get yourself one of those nice serge skirts they're selling at Lord and Taylor's?" she said one day. "They're the circular style, and they're going to be worn from now on. A dark blue one would look so nice on you."
Carrie listened with eager ears. These things never came up between her and Hurstwood. Nevertheless, she began to suggest one thing and another, which Hurstwood agreed to without any expression of opinion. He noticed the new tendency on Carrie's part, and finally, hearing much of Mrs. Vance and her delightful ways, suspected whence the change came. He was not inclined to offer the slightest objection so soon, but he felt that Carrie's wants were expanding. This did not appeal to him exactly, but he cared for her in his own way, and so the thing stood. Still, there was something in the details of the transactions which caused Carrie to feel that her requests were not a delight to him. He did not enthuse over the purchases. This led her to believe that neglect was creeping in, and so another small wedge was entered. Nevertheless, one of the results of Mrs. Vance's suggestions was the fact that on this occasion Carrie was dressed somewhat to her own satisfaction. She had on her best, but there was comfort in the thought that if she must confine herself to a best, it was neat and fitting. She looked the well-groomed woman of 21, and Mrs. Vance praised her, which brought color to her plump cheeks and a noticeable brightness into her large eyes. It was threatening rain, and Mr. Vance, at his wife's request, had called a coach.
"Your husband isn't coming?" suggested Mr. Vance as he met Carrie in his little parlor. No, he said he wouldn't be home for dinner.
Better leave a little note for him, telling him where we are. He might turn up.
I will, said Carrie, who had not thought of it before.
Tell him we'll be at Sherry's until 8 o'clock. He knows, though, I guess.
Carrie crossed the hall with rustling skirts and scrawled the note, gloves on. When she returned, a newcomer was in the Vance flat.
Mrs. Wheeler, let me introduce Mr. Ames, a cousin of mine, said Mrs. Vance. He's going along with us, aren't you, Bob?
I'm very glad to meet you, said Ames, bowing politely to Carrie.
The latter caught in a glance the dimensions of a very stalwart figure. She also noticed that he was smooth-shaven, good-looking, and young, but nothing more.
Mr. Ames is just down in New York for a few days, put in Vance, and we're trying to show him around a little.
Oh, are you? Said Carrie, taking another glance at the newcomer.
Yes, I'm just on here from Indianapolis for a week or so, said young Ames, seating himself on the edge of a chair to wait while Mrs. Vance completed the last touches of her toilet.
I guess you find New York quite a thing to see, don't you? Said Carrie, venturing something to avoid a possible deadly silence.
It is rather large to get around in a week, answered Ames pleasantly.
He was an exceedingly genial soul, this young man, and wholly free of affectation. It seemed to Carrie he was as yet only overcoming the last traces of the bashfulness of youth. He did not seem apt at conversation, but he had the merit of being well-dressed and wholly courageous. Carrie felt as if it were not going to be hard to talk to him.
Well, I guess we're ready now. The coach is outside.
Come on, people, said Mrs. Vance, coming in smiling. Bob, you'll have to look after Mrs. Wheeler.
I'll try to, said Bob, smiling and edging closer to Carrie. You won't need much watching, will you? He volunteered, in a sort of ingratiating and help-me-out kind of way.
Not very, I hope, said Carrie. They descended the stairs, Mrs. Vance offering suggestions, and climbed into the open coach.
All right, said Vance, slamming the coach door, and the conveyance rolled away.
What is it we're going to see? Asked Ames.
Southern, said Vance, in Lord Cholmondeley.
Oh, he is so good, said Mrs. Vance. He's just the funniest man.
I notice the papers praise it, said Ames. I haven't any doubt, put in Vance, but we'll all enjoy it very much.
Ames had taken a seat beside Carrie, and accordingly he felt it his bounden duty to pay her some attention. He was interested to find her so young a wife, and so pretty, though it was only a respectful interest. He had nothing of the dashing ladies' man about him. He had respect for the married state, and thought only of some pretty marriageable girls in Indianapolis.
"Are you a born New Yorker?" asked Ames of Carrie.
"Oh, no. I've only been here for 2 years."
"Oh, well, you've had time to see a great deal of it, anyhow."
I don't seem to have, answered Carrie. It's about as strange to me as when I first came here.
You're not from the West, are you?
Yes, I'm from Wisconsin, she answered.
Well, it does seem as if most people in this town haven't been here so very long. I hear lots of Indiana people in my line who are here.
What is your line? Asked Carrie.
I'm connected with an electrical company, said the youth.
Carrie followed up this desultory conversation with occasional interruptions from the Vances. Several times it became general and partially humorous, and in that manner the restaurant was reached. Carrie had noticed the appearance of gaiety and pleasure-seeking in the streets which they were following. Coaches were numerous, pedestrians many, and in 59th Street the streetcars were crowded. At 59th Street and 5th Avenue, a blaze of lights from several new hotels which bordered the Plaza Square gave a suggestion of sumptuous hotel life. 5th Avenue, the home of the wealthy, was noticeably crowded with carriages and gentlemen in evening dress. At Sherry's, an imposing doorman opened the coach door and helped them out. Young Ames held Carrie's elbow as he helped her up the steps. They entered the lobby already swarming with patrons, and then, after divesting themselves of their wraps, went into a sumptuous dining room. In all Carrie's experience, she had never seen anything like this. In the whole time she had been in New York, Hurstwood's modified state had not permitted his bringing her to such a place.
There was an almost indescribable atmosphere about it which convinced the newcomer that this was the proper thing. Here was the place where the matter of expense limited the patrons to the moneyed or pleasure-loving class. Carrie had read of it often in the morning and evening world. She had seen notices of dances, parties, balls, and suppers at Sherry's. The Mrs. So-and-so would give a party on Wednesday evening at Sherry's. Young Mr. So-and-so would entertain a party of friends at a private luncheon on the 16th at Sherry's. The common run of conventional, perfunctory notices of the doings of society, which she could scarcely refrain from scanning each day, had given her a distinct idea of the gorgeousness and luxury of this wonderful temple of gastronomy. Now, at last, she was really in it. She had come up the imposing steps, guarded by the large and portly doorman. She had seen the lobby, guarded by another large and portly gentleman, and been waited upon by uniformed youths who took care of canes, overcoats, and the like. Here was the splendid dining chamber, all decorated and aglow, where the wealthy ate. Ah, how fortunate was Mrs. Vance! Young, beautiful, and well off, at least sufficiently so to come here in a coach. What a wonderful thing it was to be rich! Vance led the way through lanes of shining tables, at which were seated parties of two, three, four, five, or six. The air of assurance and dignity about it all was exceedingly noticeable to the novitiate. Incandescent lights, the reflection of their glow in polished glasses, and the shine of gilt upon the walls, combined into one tone of light which it requires minutes of complacent observation to separate and take particular note of. The white shirt fronts of the gentlemen, the bright costumes of the ladies, diamonds, jewels, fine feathers, all were exceedingly noticeable. Carrie walked with an air equal to that of Mrs. Vance, and accepted the seat which the head waiter provided for her. She was keenly aware of all the little things that were done, the little genuflections and attentions of the waiters and head waiter which Americans pay for. The air with which the latter pulled out each chair, and the wave of the hand with which he motioned them to be seated, were worth several dollars in themselves. Once seated, there began that exhibition of showy, wasteful, and unwholesome gastronomy as practiced by wealthy Americans, which is the wonder and astonishment of true culture and dignity the world over. The large bill of fare held an array of dishes sufficient to feed an army, sidelined with prices which made reasonable expenditure a ridiculous impossibility. An order of soup at 50 cents or a dollar, with a dozen kinds to choose from. Oysters in 40 styles and at 60 cents the half dozen. Entrees, fish, and meats at prices which would house one overnight in an average hotel. $1.50 and $2 seemed to be the most common figures upon this most tastefully printed bill of fare. Carrie noticed this, and in scanning it, the price of spring chicken carried her back to that other bill of fare and far different occasion when, for the first time, she sat with Drouet in a good restaurant in Chicago. It was only momentary, a sad note as out of an old song, and then it was gone. But in that flash was seen the other Carrie, poor, hungry, drifting at her wit's end, and all Chicago a cold and closed world from which she only wandered because she could not find work. On the walls were designs in color, square spots of robin's egg blue, set in ornate frames of gilt, whose corners were elaborate moldings of fruit and flowers, with fat cupids hovering in angelic comfort. On the ceilings were colored traceries with more gilt, leading to a center where spread a cluster of lights, incandescent globes mingled with glittering prisms and stucco tendrils of gilt. The floor was of a reddish hue, waxed and polished, and in every direction were mirrors, tall, brilliant, bevel-edged mirrors, reflecting and re-reflecting forms, faces, and candelabra a score and a hundred times. The tables were not so remarkable in themselves, and yet the imprint of Sherry upon the napery, the name of Tiffany upon the silverware, the name of Haviland upon the china, and over all the glow of the small red-shaded candelabra and the reflected tints of the walls on garments and faces made them seem remarkable. Each waiter added an air of exclusiveness and elegance by the manner in which he bowed, scraped, touched, and trifled with things. The exclusively personal attention which he devoted to each one, standing half-bent, ear to one side, elbows akimbo, saying, "Soup, green turtle, yes. One portion, yes. Oyster, certainly, half dozen, yes. Asparagus, olives, yes." It would be the same with each one, only Vance essayed to order for all, inviting counsel and suggestions. Carrie studied the company with open eyes. So this was high life in New York. It was so that the rich spent their days and evenings. Her poor little mind could not rise above applying each scene to all society. Every fine lady must be in the crowd on Broadway in the afternoon, in the theater at the matinee, in the coaches and dining halls at night. It must be glow and shine everywhere, with coaches waiting and footmen attending, and she was out of it all. In 2 long years she had never even been in such a place as this. Vance was in his element here, as Hurstwood would have been in former days. He ordered freely of soup, oysters, roast meats, and side dishes, and had several bottles of wine brought, which were set down beside the table in a wicker basket. Ames was looking away rather abstractedly at the crowd and showed an interesting profile to Carrie. His forehead was high, his nose rather large and strong, his chin moderately pleasing. He had a good, wide, well-shaped mouth, and his dark brown hair was parted slightly on one side. He seemed to have the least touch of boyishness to Carrie, and yet he was a man full grown. "Do you know," he said, turning back to Carrie after his reflection, "I sometimes think it is a shame for people to spend so much money this way." Carrie looked at him a moment with the faintest touch of surprise at his seriousness. He seemed to be thinking about something over which she had never pondered. "Do you?" she answered, interestedly. "Yes," he said. "They pay so much more than these things are worth. They put on so much show." "I don't know why people shouldn't spend when they have it," said Mrs. Vance. "It doesn't do any harm," said Vance, who was still studying the bill of fare, though he had ordered. Ames was looking away again, and Carrie was again looking at his forehead. To her, he seemed to be thinking about strange things. As he studied the crowd, his eye was mild. "Look at that woman's dress over there," he said, again turning to Carrie and nodding in a direction. "Where?" said Carrie, following his eyes. "Over there in the corner, way over. Do you see that brooch?" "Isn't it large?" said Carrie. "One of the largest cluster of jewels I have ever seen," said Ames. "It is, isn't it?" said Carrie. She felt as if she would like to be agreeable to this young man, and also there came with it, or perhaps preceded it, the slightest shade of a feeling that he was better educated than she was, that his mind was better. He seemed to look at, and the saving grace in Carrie was that she could understand that people could be wiser. She had seen a number of people in her life who reminded her of what she had vaguely come to think of as scholars. This strong young man beside her, with his clear, natural look, seemed to get a hold of things which she did not quite understand, but approved of. It was fine to be so, as a man, she thought. The conversation changed to a book that was having its vogue at the time, Molding a Maiden by Albert Ross. Mrs. Vance had read it. Vance had seen it discussed in some of the papers. "A man can make quite a strike writing a book," said Vance. "I notice this fellow Ross is very much talked about." He was looking at Carrie as he spoke. "I hadn't heard of him," said Carrie honestly. "Oh, I have," said Mrs. Vance. "He's written lots of things. This last story is pretty good." "He doesn't amount to much," said Ames. Carrie turned her eyes toward him as to an oracle. "His stuff is nearly as bad as Dora Thorne," concluded Ames. Carrie felt this as a personal reproof. She read Dora Thorne, or had, a great deal in the past. It seemed only fair to her, but she supposed the people thought it very fine. Now this clear-eyed, fine-headed youth, who looked something like a student to her, made fun of it. It was poor to him, not worth reading. She looked down, and for the first time felt the pain of not understanding. Yet there was nothing sarcastic or supercilious in the way Ames spoke. He had very little of that in him. Carrie felt that it was just kindly thought of a high order, the right thing to think, and wondered what else was right, according to him. He seemed to notice that she listened and rather sympathized with him, and from now on he talked mostly to her. As the waiter bowed and scraped about, felt the dishes to see if they were hot enough, brought spoons and forks, and did all those little attentive things calculated to impress the luxury of the situation upon the diner, Ames also leaned slightly to one side and told her of Indianapolis in an intelligent way. He really had a very bright mind, which was finding its chief development in electrical knowledge. His sympathies for other forms of information, however, and for types of people, were quick and warm. The red glow on his head gave it a sandy tinge and put a bright glint in his eye. Carrie noticed all these things as he leaned toward her and felt exceedingly young. This man was far ahead of her. He seemed wiser than Hurstwood, saner and brighter than Drouet. He seemed innocent and clean, and she thought that he was exceedingly pleasant. She noticed also that his interest in her was a far-off one. She was not in his life, nor any of the things that touched his life, and yet now, as he spoke of these things, they appealed to her. "I shouldn't care to be rich," he told her, as the dinner proceeded and the supply of food warmed up his sympathies. "Not rich enough to spend my money this way."
"Oh, wouldn't you?" said Carrie, the, to her, new attitude forcing itself distinctly upon her for the first time.
"No," he said. "What good would it do? A man doesn't need this sort of thing to be happy." Carrie thought of this doubtfully, but coming from him it had weight with her.
"He probably could be happy," she thought to herself, "all alone. He's so strong."
Mr. and Mrs. Vance kept up a running fire of interruptions, and these impressive things by Ames came at odd moments. They were sufficient, however, for the atmosphere that went with this youth impressed itself upon Carrie without words. There was something in him, or the world he moved in, which appealed to her. He reminded her of scenes she had seen on the stage, the sorrows and sacrifices that always went with she knew not what. He had taken away some of the bitterness of the contrast between this life and her life, and all by a certain calm indifference which concerned only him. As they went out, he took her arm and helped her into the coach, and then they were off again, and so to the show. During the acts, Carrie found herself listening to him very attentively. He mentioned things in the play which she most approved of, things which swayed her deeply.
"Don't you think it rather fine to be an actor?" she asked once.
"Yes, I do," he said, "to be a good one. I think the theater a great thing." Just this little approval set Carrie's heart bounding. Ah, if she could only be an actress, a good one. This man was wise. He knew, and he approved of it. If she were a fine actress, such men as he would approve of her. She felt that he was good to speak as he had, although it did not concern her at all. She did not know why she felt this way. At the close of the show, it suddenly developed that he was not going back with them.
"Oh, aren't you?" said Carrie, with an unwarrantable feeling.
"Oh, no," he said. "I'm stopping right around here in 33rd Street." Carrie could not say anything else, but somehow this development shocked her. She had been regretting the wane of a pleasant evening, but she had thought there was a half-hour more. Oh, the half-hours, the minutes of the world, what miseries and griefs are crowded into them. She said goodbye with feigned indifference. What matter could it make? Still, the coach seemed lorn. When she went into her own flat, she had this to think about. She did not know whether she would ever see this man any more. What difference could it make? What difference could it make?
Hurstwood had returned and was already in bed. His clothes were scattered loosely about. Carrie came to the door and saw him, then retreated. She did not want to go in yet a while. She wanted to think. It was disagreeable to her. Back in the dining room, she sat in her chair and rocked. Her little hands were folded tightly as she thought. Through a fog of longing and conflicting desires, she was beginning to see. O ye legions of hope and pity, of sorrow and pain, she was rocking and beginning to see.
33. Without the walled city, the slope of the years.
The immediate result of this was nothing. Results from such things are usually long in growing. Morning brings a change of feeling. The existent condition invariably pleads for itself. It is only at odd moments that we get glimpses of the misery of things. The heart understands when it is confronted with contrasts. Take them away, and the ache subsides. Carrie went on leading much this same life for 6 months thereafter or more. She did not see Ames anymore. He called once upon the Vances, but she only heard about it through the young wife. Then he went west, and there was a gradual subsidence of whatever personal attraction had existed. The mental effect of the thing had not gone, however, and never would entirely. She had an ideal to contrast men by, particularly men close to her. During all this time, a period rapidly approaching 3 years, Hurstwood had been moving along in an even path. There was no apparent slope downward, and distinctly none upward, so far as the casual observer might have seen. But psychologically there was a change, which was marked enough to suggest the future very distinctly indeed. This was in the mere matter of the halt his career had received when he departed from Chicago. A man's fortune or material progress is very much the same as his bodily growth. Either he is growing stronger, healthier, wiser, as the youth approaching manhood, or he is growing weaker, older, less incisive mentally, as the man approaching old age. There are no other states. Frequently there is a period between the cessation of youthful accretion and the setting in the case of the middle-aged man, of the tendency toward decay when the two processes are almost perfectly balanced and there is little doing in either direction. Given time enough, however, the balance becomes a sagging to the grave side. Slowly at first, then with a modest momentum, and at last the graveward process is in the full swing. So it is frequently with man's fortune. If its process of accretion is never halted, if the balancing stage is never reached, there will be no toppling. Rich men are frequently, in these days, saved from this dissolution of their fortune by their ability to hire younger brains. These younger brains look upon the interests of the fortune as their own, and so steady and direct its progress. If each individual were left absolutely to the care of his own interests, and were given time enough in which to grow exceedingly old, his fortune would pass as his strength and will. He and his would be utterly dissolved and scattered unto the four winds of the heavens. But now see wherein the parallel changes. A fortune, like a man, is an organism which draws to itself other minds and other strength than that inherent in the founder. Besides the young minds drawn to it by salaries, it becomes allied with young forces, which make for its existence even when the strength and wisdom of the founder are fading. It may be conserved by the growth of a community or of a state. It may be involved in providing something for which there is a growing demand. This removes it at once beyond the special care of the founder. It needs not so much foresight now as direction. The man wanes, the need continues or grows, and the fortune, fallen into whose hands it may, continues.
Hence, some men never recognize the turning in the tide of their abilities. It is only in chance cases where a fortune or a state of success is wrested from them that the lack of ability to do as they did formerly becomes apparent. Hurstwood, set down under new conditions, was in a position to see that he was no longer young. If he did not, it was due wholly to the fact that his state was so well balanced that an absolute change for the worse did not show. Not trained to reason or introspect himself, he could not analyze the change that was taking place in his mind and hence his body, but he felt the depression of it. Constant comparisons between his old state and his new showed a balance for the worse, which produced a constant state of gloom, or at least depression. Now, it has been shown experimentally that a constantly subdued frame of mind produces certain poisons in the blood called catastates, such as virtuous feelings of pleasure and delight produce helpful chemicals called anastates. The poisons generated by remorse inveigh against the system and eventually produce marked physical deterioration. To these, Hurstwood was subject. In the course of time, it told upon his temper. His eye no longer possessed that buoyant, searching shrewdness which had characterized it in Adam Street. His step was not as sharp and firm. He was given to thinking, thinking, thinking. The new friends he made were not celebrities. They were of a cheaper, a slightly more sensual and cruder grade. He could not possibly take the pleasure in this company that he had in that of those fine frequenters of the Chicago resort. He was left to brood. Slowly, exceedingly slowly, his desire to greet, conciliate, and make at home these people who visited the Warren Street place passed from him. More and more slowly, the significance of the realm he had left began to be clear. It did not seem so wonderful to be in it when he was in it. It had seemed very easy for anyone to get up there and have ample raiment and money to spend, but now that he was out of it, how far off it became. He began to see as one sees a city with a wall about it. Men were posted at the gates. You could not get in. Those inside did not care to come out to see who you were. They were so merry inside that all those outside were forgotten, and he was on the outside. Each day he could read in the evening papers of the doings within this walled city. In the notices of passengers for Europe, he read the names of eminent frequenters of his old resort. In the theatrical column appeared, from time to time, announcements of the latest successes of men he had known. He knew that they were at their old gaieties. Pullmans were hauling them to and fro about the land. Papers were greeting them with interesting mentions. The elegant lobbies of hotels and the glow of polished dining rooms were keeping them close within the walled city. Men whom he had known, men whom he had tipped glasses with, rich men, and he was forgotten. Who was Mr. Wheeler? What was the Warren Street Resort? Bah! If one thinks that such thoughts do not come to so common a type of mind, that such feelings require a higher mental development, I would urge for their consideration the fact that it is the higher mental development that does away with such thoughts. It is the higher mental development which induces philosophy, and that fortitude which refuses to dwell upon such things, refuses to be made to suffer by their consideration. The common type of mind is exceedingly keen on all matters which relate to its physical welfare, exceedingly keen. It is the unintellectual miser who sweats blood at the loss of $100. It is the Epictetus who smiles when the last vestige of physical welfare is removed. The time came, in the third year, when this thinking began to produce results in the Warren Street place. The tide of patronage dropped a little below what it had been at its best since he had been there. This irritated and worried him. There came a night when he confessed to Carrie that the business was not doing as well this month as it had the month before. This was in lieu of certain suggestions she had made concerning little things she wanted to buy. She had not failed to notice that he did not seem to consult her about buying clothes for himself. For the first time, it struck her as a ruse, or that he said it so that she would not think of asking for things. Her reply was mild enough, but her thoughts were rebellious. He was not looking after her at all. She was depending for her enjoyment upon the Vances. And now the latter announced that they were going away. It was approaching spring, and they were going north. "Oh, yes," said Mrs. Vance to Carrie. "We think we might as well give up the flat and store our things. We'll be gone for the summer, and it would be a useless expense. I think we'll settle a little farther downtown when we come back." Carrie heard this with genuine sorrow. She had enjoyed Mrs. Vance's companionship so much. There was no one else in the house whom she knew. Again, she would be all alone. Hurstwood's gloom over the slight decrease in profits and the departure of the Vances came together. So Carrie had loneliness and this mood of her husband to enjoy at the same time. It was a grievous thing. She became restless and dissatisfied, not exactly, as she thought, with Hurstwood, but with life. What was it? A very dull round indeed. What did she have? Nothing but this narrow little flat. The Vances could travel. They could do the things worth doing, and here she was. For what was she made, anyhow? More thought followed, and then tears. Tears seemed justified, and the only relief in the world. For another period this state continued, the twain leading a rather monotonous life, and then there was a slight change for the worse. One evening, Hurstwood, after thinking about a way to modify Carrie's desire for clothes and the general strain upon his ability to provide, said, "I don't think I'll ever be able to do much with Shaughnessy." "What's the matter?" said Carrie. "Oh, he's a slow, greedy mick. He won't agree to anything to improve the place, and it won't ever pay without it."
"Can't you make him?" said Carrie.
"No, I've tried. The only thing I can see, if I want to improve, is to get hold of a place of my own."
"Why don't you?" said Carrie.
"Well, all I have is tied up in there just now. If I had a chance to save a while, I think I could open a place that would give us plenty of money."
"Can't we save?" said Carrie.
"We might try it," he suggested. "I've been thinking that if we take a smaller flat downtown and live economically for a year, I would have enough, with what I have invested, to open a good place. Then we could arrange to live as you want to."
"It would suit me all right," said Carrie, who nevertheless felt badly to think it had come to this. Talk of a smaller flat sounded like poverty.
"There are lots of nice little flats down around 6th Avenue, below 14th Street. We might get one down there."
"I'll look at them, if you say so," said Carrie.
"I think I could break away from this fellow inside of a year," said Hurstwood. "Nothing will ever come of this arrangement as it's going on now."
"I'll look around," said Carrie, observing that the proposed change seemed to be a serious thing with him. The upshot of this was that the change was eventually effected, not without great gloom on the part of Carrie. It really affected her more seriously than anything that had yet happened. She began to look upon Hurstwood wholly as a man, and not as a lover or husband. She felt thoroughly bound to him as a wife, and that her lot was cast with his, whatever it might be. But she began to see that he was gloomy and taciturn, not a young, strong, and buoyant man. He looked a little bit old to her about the eyes and mouth now, and there were other things which placed him in his true rank, so far as her estimation was concerned. She began to feel that she had made a mistake. Incidentally, she also began to recall the fact that he had practically forced her to flee with him. The new flat was located in 13th Street, a half block west of 6th Avenue, and contained only four rooms.
The new neighborhood did not appeal to Carrie as much. There were no trees here, no west view of the river. The street was solidly built up. There were 12 families here, respectable enough, but nothing like the Vances. Richer people required more space. Being left alone in this little place, Carrie did without a girl. She made it charming enough, but could not make it delight her. Hurstwood was not inwardly pleased to think that they should have to modify their state, but he argued that he could do nothing. He must put the best face on it and let it go at that. He tried to show Carrie that there was no cause for financial alarm, but only congratulation over the chance he would have at the end of the year by taking her rather more frequently to the theater and by providing a liberal table. This was for the time only. He was getting in the frame of mind where he wanted principally to be alone and to be allowed to think. The disease of brooding was beginning to claim him as a victim. Only the newspapers and his own thoughts were worthwhile. The delight of love had again slipped away. It was a case of live now, making the best you can out of a very commonplace station in life. The road downward has but few landings and level places. The very state of his mind, superinduced by his condition, caused the breach to widen between him and his partner. At last, that individual began to wish that Hurstwood was out of it. It so happened, however, that a real estate deal on the part of the owner of the land arranged things even more effectually than ill will could have schemed. "Did you see that?" said Shaughnessy one morning to Hurstwood, pointing to the real estate column in a copy of the Herald which he held. "No, what is it?" said Hurstwood, looking down the items of news. "The man who owns this ground has sold it." "You don't say so," said Hurstwood. He looked, and there was the notice. Mr. August Vila had yesterday registered the transfer of the lot, 25 by 75 feet, at the corner of Warren and Hudson Streets, to J.F. Slauson for the sum of $57,000. "Our lease expires when?" asked Hurstwood, thinking. "Next February, isn't it?" "That's right," said Shaughnessy. "It doesn't say what the new man's going to do with it," remarked Hurstwood, looking back to the paper. "We'll hear, I guess, soon enough," said Shaughnessy. Sure enough, it did develop. Mr. Slauson owned the property adjoining and was going to put up a modern office building. The present one was to be torn down. It would take probably a year and a half to complete the other one." All these things developed by degrees, and Hurstwood began to ponder over what would become of the saloon. One day he spoke about it to his partner. "Do you think it would be worthwhile to open up somewhere else in the neighborhood?" "What would be the use?" said Shaughnessy. "We couldn't get another corner around here." "It wouldn't pay anywhere else, do you think?" "I wouldn't try it," said the other. The approaching change now took on a most serious aspect to Hurstwood. Dissolution meant the loss of his $1,000, and he could not save another $1,000 in the time. He understood that Shaughnessy was merely tired of the arrangement and would probably lease the new corner when completed alone. He began to worry about the necessity of a new connection and to see impending serious financial straits unless something turned up. This left him in no mood to enjoy his flat or Carrie, and consequently the depression invaded that quarter. Meanwhile, he took such time as he could to look about, but opportunities were not numerous. More, he had not the same impressive personality which he had when he first came to New York. Bad thoughts had put a shade into his eyes which did not impress others favorably. Neither had he $1,300 in hand to talk with. About a month later, finding that he had not made any progress, Shaughnessy reported definitely that Slauson would not extend the lease. "I guess this thing's got to come to an end," he said, affecting an air of concern. "Well, if it has, it has," answered Hurstwood grimly. He would not give the other a key to his opinions, whatever they were. He should not have the satisfaction. A day or two later, he saw that he must say something to Carrie. "You know," he said, "I think I'm going to get the worst of my deal down there." How is that? Asked Carrie in astonishment.
Well, the man who owns the ground has sold it, and the new owner won't release it to us. The business may come to an end.
Can't you start somewhere else?
There doesn't seem to be any place. Shaughnessy doesn't want to.
Do you lose what you put in?
Yes, said Hurstwood, whose face was a study.
Oh, isn't that too bad, said Carrie.
It's a trick, said Hurstwood. That's all. They'll start another place there, all right.
Carrie looked at him and gathered from his whole demeanor what it meant. It was serious, very serious.
Do you think you can get something else? She ventured timidly.
Hurstwood thought a while. It was all up with the bluff about money and investment. She could see now that he was broke.
I don't know, he said solemnly. I can try.
XXXIV. The grind of the millstones. A sample of chaff. Carrie pondered over this situation as consistently as Hurstwood once she got the facts adjusted in her mind. It took several days for her to fully realize that the approach of the dissolution of her husband's business meant commonplace struggle and privation. Her mind went back to her early venture in Chicago, the Hansons and their flat, and her heart revolted. That was terrible. Everything about poverty was terrible. She wished she knew a way out. Her recent experiences with the Vances had wholly unfitted her to view her own state with complacence. The glamour of the high life of the city had, in the few experiences afforded her by the former, seized her completely. She had been taught how to dress and where to go without having ample means to do either. Now these things, ever-present realities as they were, filled her eyes and mind. The more circumscribed became her state, the more entrancing seemed this other. And now poverty threatened to seize her entirely, and to remove this other world far upward, like a heaven to which any Lazarus might extend appealingly his hands. So, too, the ideal brought into her life by Ames remained. He had gone, but here was his word that riches were not everything, that there was a great deal more in the world than she knew, that the stage was good and the literature she read poor. He was a strong man and clean. How much stronger and better than Hurstwood and Drouet she only half formulated to herself, but the difference was painful. It was something to which she voluntarily closed her eyes. During the last 3 months of the Warren Street connection, Hurstwood took parts of days off and hunted, tracking the business advertisements. It was a more or less depressing business, partly because of the thought that he must soon get something, or he would begin to live on the few $100 he was saving, and then he would have nothing to invest. He would have to hire out as a clerk. Everything he discovered in this line advertised as an opportunity was either too expensive or too wretched for him. Besides, winter was coming, the papers were announcing hardships, and there was a general feeling of hard times in the air, or at least he thought so. In his worry, other people's worries became apparent. No item about a firm failing, a family starving, or a man dying upon the streets, supposedly of starvation, but arrested his eye as he scanned the morning papers. Once the world came out with a flaring announcement about 80,000 people out of employment in New York this winter, which struck as a knife at his heart. 80,000, he thought. What an awful thing that is. This was new reasoning for Hurstwood. In the old days, the world had seemed to be getting along well enough. He had been wont to see similar things in the daily news in Chicago, but they did not hold his attention. Now these things were like gray clouds hovering along the horizon of a clear day. They threatened to cover and obscure his life with chilly grayness. He tried to shake them off, to forget and brace up. Sometimes he said to himself mentally, "What's the use of worrying? I'm not out yet. I got 6 weeks more." Even if worst comes to worst, I've got enough to live on for 6 months. Curiously, as he troubled over his future, his thoughts occasionally reverted to his wife and family. He had avoided such thoughts for the first 3 years as much as possible. He hated her, and he could get along without her. Let her go. He would do well enough. Now, however, when he was not doing well enough, he began to wonder what she was doing, how his children were getting along. He could see them living as nicely as ever, occupying the comfortable house and using his property. "By George, it's a shame they should have it all," he vaguely thought to himself on several occasions. "I didn't do anything." As he looked back now and analyzed the situation which led up to his taking the money, he began mildly to justify himself. What had he done? What in the world that should bar him out this way and heap such difficulties upon him? It seemed only yesterday to him since he was comfortable and well-to-do, but now it was all wrested from him. "She didn't deserve what she got out of me, that is sure. I didn't do so much. If everybody could just know." There was no thought that the facts ought to be advertised. It was only a mental justification he was seeking from himself, something that would enable him to bear his state as a righteous man. One afternoon, 5 weeks before the Warren Street place closed up, he left the saloon to visit 3 or 4 places he saw advertised in the Herald. One was down in Gold Street, and he visited that but did not enter. It was such a cheap-looking place he felt that he could not abide it. Another was on the Bowery, which he knew contained many showy resorts. It was near Grand Street and turned out to be very handsomely fitted up. He talked around about investments for fully 3/4 of an hour with the proprietor, who maintained that his health was poor and that was the reason he wished a partner. "Well, now, just how much money would it take to buy a half-interest here?" said Hurstwood, who saw $700 as his limit. "$3,000, said the man. Hurstwood's jaw fell. "Cash?" he said. "Cash." He tried to put on an air of deliberation as one who might really buy, but his eyes showed gloom. He wound up by saying he would think it over and came away. The man he had been talking to sensed his condition in a vague way. "I don't think he wants to buy," he said to himself. "He doesn't talk right." The afternoon was as gray as lead and cold. It was blowing up a disagreeable winter wind. He visited a place far up on the east side near 69th Street, and it was 5 o'clock and growing dim when he reached there. A portly German kept this place. "How about this ad of yours?" asked Hurstwood, who rather objected to the looks of the place. "Oh, that is all over," said the German. "I will not sell now." "Oh, is that so?" "Yes. There is nothing to dot. It is all over." "Very well," said Hurstwood, turning around. The German paid no more attention to him, and it made him angry. "The crazy ass," he said to himself. "What does he want to advertise for?" Wholly depressed, he started for 13th Street. The flat had only a light in the kitchen where Carrie was working. He struck a match and, lighting the gas, sat down in the dining room without even greeting her. She came to the door and looked in. "It's you, is it?" she said, and went back. "Yes," he said, without even looking up from the evening paper he had bought. Carrie saw things were wrong with him. He was not so handsome when gloomy. The lines at the sides of the eyes were deepened. Naturally dark of skin, gloom made him look slightly sinister. He was quite a disagreeable figure. Carrie set the table and brought in the meal. "Dinner's ready," she said, passing him for something. He did not answer, reading on. She came in and sat down at her place, feeling exceedingly wretched. "Won't you eat now?" she asked. He folded his paper and drew near, silence holding for a time, except for the pass-me's. "It's been gloomy today, hasn't it?" ventured Carrie after a time. "Yes," he said. He only picked at his food. Are you still sure to close up? Said Carrie, venturing to take up the subject which they had discussed often enough.
Of course we are, he said, with the slightest modification of sharpness.
This retort angered Carrie. She had had a dreary day of it herself.
You needn't talk like that, she said.
Oh, he exclaimed, pushing back from the table as if to say more, but letting it go at that. Then he picked up his paper.
Carrie left her seat, containing herself with difficulty. He saw she was hurt.
Don't go away, he said as she started back into the kitchen. Eat your dinner.
She passed, not answering. He looked at the paper a few moments and then rose up and put on his coat.
I'm going downtown, Carrie, he said, coming out. I'm out of sorts tonight.
She did not answer.
Don't be angry, he said. It will be all right tomorrow.
He looked at her, but she paid no attention to him, working at her dishes.
Goodbye, he said finally, and went out.
This was the first strong result of the situation between them, but with the nearing of the last day of the business, the gloom became almost a permanent thing. Hurstwood could not conceal his feelings about the matter. Carrie could not help wondering where she was drifting. It got so that they talked even less than usual, and yet it was not Hurstwood who felt any objection to Carrie. It was Carrie who shied away from him. This he noticed. It aroused an objection to her becoming indifferent to him. He made the possibility of friendly intercourse almost a giant task, and then noticed with discontent that Carrie added to it by her manner and made it more impossible. At last the final day came. When it actually arrived, Hurstwood, who had got his mind into such a state where a thunderclap and raging storm would have seemed highly appropriate, was rather relieved to find that it was a plain, ordinary day. The sun shone, the temperature was pleasant. He felt, as he came to the breakfast table, that it wasn't so terrible after all.
Well, he said to Carrie, today is my last day on earth.
Carrie smiled in answer to his humor. Hurstwood glanced over his paper rather gaily. He seemed to have lost a load.
I'll go down for a little while, he said after breakfast, and then I'll look around. Tomorrow I'll spend the whole day looking about. I think I can get something now this thing's off my hands.
He went out smiling and visited the place. Shaughnessy was there. They had made all arrangements to share according to their interests. When, however, he had been there several hours, gone out three more, and returned, his elation had departed. As much as he had objected to the place, now that it was no longer to exist, he felt sorry. He wished that things were different. Shaughnessy was coolly businesslike.
Well, he said at 5 o'clock, we might as well count the change and divide.
They did so. The fixtures had already been sold, and the sum divided.
Good night, said Hurstwood at the final moment, in a last effort to be genial.
So long, said Shaughnessy, scarcely deigning a notice. Thus the Warren Street arrangement was permanently concluded. Carrie had prepared a good dinner at the flat, but after his ride up, Hurstwood was in a solemn and reflective mood.
Well? Said Carrie inquisitively.
I'm out of that, he answered, taking off his coat.
As she looked at him, she wondered what his financial state was now. They ate and talked a little.
Will you have enough to buy in anywhere else? Asked Carrie.
No, he said. I'll have to get something else and save up.
It would be nice if you could get someplace, said Carrie, prompted by anxiety and hope.
I guess I will, he said reflectively.
For some days thereafter, he put on his overcoat regularly in the morning and sallied forth. On these ventures, he first consoled himself with the thought that with the $700 he had, he could still make some advantageous arrangement. He thought about going to some brewery, which, as he knew, frequently controlled saloons which they leased, and get them to help him. Then he remembered that he would have to pay out several hundred anyway for fixtures, and that he would have nothing left for his monthly expenses. It was costing him nearly $80 a month to live. No, he said in his sanest moments. I can't do it. I'll get something else and save up. This getting something proposition complicated itself the moment he began to think of what it was he wanted to do. Manage a place? Where should he get such a position? The papers contained no requests for managers. Such positions, he knew well enough, were either secured by long years of service or were bought with a half or third interest. Into a place important enough to need such a manager, he had not enough money to buy. Nevertheless, he started out. His clothes were very good and his appearance still excellent, but it involved the trouble of diluting. People, looking at him, imagined instantly that a man of his age, stout and well-dressed, must be well off. He appeared a comfortable owner of something, a man from whom the common run of mortals could well expect gratuities. Being now 43 years of age and comfortably built, walking was not easy. He had not been used to exercise for many years. His legs tired, his shoulders ached, and his feet pained him at the close of the day, even when he took streetcars in almost every direction. The mere getting up and down, if long continued, produced this result. The fact that people took him to be better off than he was, he well understood. It was so painfully clear to him that it retarded his search. Not that he wished to be less well-appearing, but that he was ashamed to belie his appearance by incongruous appeals. So he hesitated, wondering what to do. He thought of the hotels, but instantly he remembered that he had no experience as a clerk and, what was more important, no acquaintances or friends in that line to whom he could go. He did know some hotel owners in several cities, including New York, but they knew of his dealings with Fitzgerald and Moy. He could not apply to them. He thought of other lines suggested by large buildings or businesses which he knew of, wholesale groceries, hardware, insurance concerns, and the like. But he had had no experience. How to go about getting anything was a bitter thought. Would he have to go personally and ask, wait outside an office door, and then, distinguished and affluent-looking, announce that he was looking for something to do? He strained painfully at the thought. No, he could not do that. He really strolled about, thinking, and then, the weather being cold, stepped into a hotel. He knew hotels well enough to know that any decent-looking individual was welcome to a chair in the lobby. This was in the Broadway Central, which was then one of the most important hotels in the city. Taking a chair here was a painful thing to him. To think he should come to this. He had heard loungers about hotels called chair-warmers. He had called them that himself in his day. But here he was, despite the possibility of meeting someone who knew him, shielding himself from cold and the weariness of the streets in a hotel lobby. "I can't do this way," he said to himself. "There's no use my starting out mornings without first thinking up some place to go. I'll think of some places and then look them up." It occurred to him that the positions of bartenders were sometimes open, but he put this out of his mind. Bartender. He, the ex-manager. It grew awfully dull sitting in the hotel lobby, and so at 4 he went home. He tried to put on a business air as he went in, but it was a feeble imitation. The rocking chair in the dining room was comfortable. He sank into it gladly, with several papers he had bought, and began to read. As she was going through the room to begin preparing dinner, Carrie said, "The man was here for the rent today." "Oh, was he?" said Hurstwood.